is a fun, exciting little thing.
That's some red pill, blue pill shit.
And it comes right back. Cool. Fuck it.
Well, let's have some fun. I'm Matt Robinson.
I'm Noah Bissell.
And this is Graining In.
Jake Hill.
Play the music. I'm in the mood to be slow and careful. My body's ready for a mountain climb. All of a sudden it will all become lovely. The flower that opens in the morning light. Ooh. You won't actually be able to hear the music, but in post, the music goes in there. You know how it works.
Radio guy.
He
the magic of radio.
Today we are excited to sit down with Chris Johnson, Green Bench Brewing, a brewery that we're very familiar with. Have you had much of their stuff, Noah?
No. Only honestly what has been occasionally distro domain, which is I think quite few and far between. But Pete and Lucy, I think, were down at your place, Chris. Not too long before COVID started.
Right before, I think.
But basically talked about it through all of COVID. So I'm very excited to get down there myself.
And certainly being past it, it's something we touched on a lot when it was going on. But did want to ask you a little bit, because Florida was kind of renowned for the way that it handled COVID, I guess I would say. What was that experience like for you the last 18 months running a brewery in Florida?
Well, I think, first of all, thanks for having me, guys. And yeah, it was fantastic having your brother down a couple times. He made it I guess 2 years ago now. It feels like a year and a half ago. It's been a weird time. So yeah, I think mostly like everyone else, it was very scary. You know, there was a lot of uncertainty. There was a lot of, really hard conversations we had to have, not just amongst ourselves as sort of ownership and management, but really hard conversations we had to have with staff that we didn't want to, you know, necessarily have, but we kind of had to so that we could maintain, the business. So the shutdowns, we had a couple of them. We were shut down kind of, you know, pretty early on, right before, literally the evening before our beer festival, Fooder for Thought, which sucked.
Jeez. But
so they shut us down right before then, like a Monday. I had all these brewers in town for it and everything. And then we ended up basically being shut down for about 2-3 months. So it was March, April, May. Yeah, about 2.5 months. And then they opened us back up with some limited capacity. And then about 3 weeks after the opening, they shut us down again because we continued to see cases rise in Florida. And yeah, jeez. And it was difficult then because the second shutdown was, they had a caveat there, which was you could open up if you were a restaurant, which mm-hmm. of course pissed off a lot of us because, we didn't really understand why that made any sense necessarily. You know, it's not to say that we wanted everyone to be shut down, you know, but we did want the actual, rules, I think, to kind of make sense across the board for any retail facility. You know, like if we had served a burger or a pizza or something, it would have been okay to come to our brewery, which that just didn't make sense to us. So we fought that for a little bit.
It was like that in Maine as well.
Yeah. Well, so I kind of understand that. Rather their reasoning for the understanding was that in a bar, people are going to drink a lot and then, you know, party. But I don't know how having food would have changed that. Did you guys get any like reasoning from your government on like why they did that? Did they say anything?
There was definitely the implication that alcohol will apparently make people kiss was kind of the vibe that I got of like, you know, once people have beer in them, they'll do, who knows what they'll do. but yeah, I guess as you say that, no, we just brought food online, like in kind of the new version post COVID, but before that didn't breweries were far from like the biggest thing was the spacing, like for us, outdoor service must have just been a godsend in Florida, I would think.
Yeah. I mean, that was the key, right? We had to limit on site how many people we could have, but you could have a little bit more if you were outdoors. And obviously, like, our weather's pretty good year round for the most part. I mean, it's hot, but it's you know, you could be outside all year. So we have we're very fortunate to have a massive outdoor space here on site. So we almost eliminated the tasting room altogether. Just kind of turned it into kind of a quick room you walk into, you order, and actually you get your beer outside. So you go inside to order your beer, you pay for it, you walk outside, and we have like a service window where we just like sort of put your order out on that window, call you, and then you pick it up, go sit down, then you can remove your mask and sort of hang out, you know? So we were fortunate. Oh, yeah, we're really fortunate to have that. But the reasoning, I guess, was the same for us too. You know, they were like, you know, you start drinking, you start, you know, just letting loose, and who knows what's going to happen next, and then boom, everyone gets COVID. So which was, again, the bizarre part was that, like, if we got food, it would it still didn't eliminate people from drinking. So if that was your logic, then I don't understand. And on top of that, restaurants could sell, you know, like, they could sell liquor. So there were, like, I would drive down Central Avenue here in St. Pete when we were shut down, and there were bars packed to the gills with people just doing shots of tequila and wasted, because this place had technically a food license, but no one was there eating. They were just there like partying as if nothing was happening.
Hot lamp of wings in the back corner.
The one, we didn't get this from the state, but in conversations I was having, the one part to play devil's advocate that did make sense a little bit that I got my head around was that, like, a lot of these breweries are essentially manufacturing businesses, and they have distro, and they have these other avenues of revenue that restaurants don't have. So it was almost like an intentful bias to help keep these restaurants going, because the breweries are going to be all right because they can distro their beer.
I do understand that to some extent. The issue with that notion, though, is that almost all of the retail accounts that these breweries sell to are also shut down. So, you know, like most of the bars that we sell to they weren't buying beer, you know, like they were shut down too. Or if they were open, they were, you know, just selling basically shots of liquor or whatever the hell it was. So like even the wholesale side tanked for most breweries that rely specifically on draft. Now, you do have those breweries that are a little bit bigger, more established. They're in grocery stores selling, you know, packaged products off-premise, which we were fortunate enough to be sort of in that bubble. We had one brand in Publix here, our, you know, large grocery store chains. So we were able to keep making beer and selling beer. But I think the majority of craft breweries, especially here in St. Petersburg at least, don't distribute at all. They're so small that they open their business to sell direct to consumer.
Paint a picture of St. Petersburg a little bit. I think of that 2013, 2014 area as being almost like a draft class, where there's a ton of breweries that came out of that timing, when a real formative years for beer, where everything was changing. And I was diving in a little bit to just kind of look at some St. Petersburg stats. I think 2012, zero breweries. And then 2013, you opened with three or four others. And as it sits now, looks like there's about 20. Just kind of paint the picture of beer culture in St. Petersburg at the time that you opened Green Bench and what it looks like now. And then want to bring it back to Fooder for Thought a little bit.
Yeah, of course. 2013 was a completely different time, man. We, like you said, 2012, there were no breweries. We were the first production brewery actually technically open in the city of St. Petersburg. There was another brewery that was licensed, actually two breweries that were licensed before us. Well, that's not true. Sorry. There was one brewery in St. Petersburg city that was licensed before us, and that was called Brewer's Tasting Room. And they were this small retail facility where like they had like a 1.5 barrel system. And the idea was, I mean, they ultimately just bought beer from wholesalers, and it was, you know, local Florida craft beer for the most part.
It sounds sick.
And then they would
very clear, effective branding, I will say that.
So what they would do is that their 1.5-barrel system, they didn't really brew beer on it. They actually set it up so that like home brewers or whatever could like come in, pay for their own ingredients, brew beer on the system, and they could sell it in the tasting room there. And, you know, they would do like a profit sharing thing with whoever wanted to commercially make a beer. And this was supposed to be some kind of like a jumping off point potentially for them to sell beer or rather pour beer for like potential investors. And it was like an incubator was kind of the idea. So really the first licensed brewery in St. Petersburg, but they weren't brewing beer. They were just licensed and kind of sitting there at the time. And then down the street from us, there's a small city kind of in like an unincorporated area here in St. Pete called Gulfport. And there was, exactly. So there was a restaurant there called Peg's Cantina. And it was run by this woman, Peg, and her son was this man named Doug Dozark. And Doug, he worked very, very briefly at like Oscar Blues years prior. I mean, at the time he was working at Cigar City Brewing. And actually I worked with him at Cigar City as well. And so basically at his mom's restaurant, they built this, you know, kind of a almost 1-barrel 3-tier system. And they were making, you know, kind of homebrewing commercially in the backyard of Peg's, and they were selling beer there. So he then turned to that, especially when Peg decided kind of that eventually she wanted to close Peg's or sell it and do another venture, that he was going to open a brewery with his wife called Cycle Brewing. So they got a space in St. Petersburg downtown, and where they didn't have a commercial license to brew, but they opened a tasting room. And their tasting room opened about one month before Green Bench's tasting room did. So, but technically we were the first licensed commercial actual making beer brewery in the city of St. Petersburg. We opened in 2013, September 25th was our first day actually opening. I think we brewed our first beer in like August, maybe 31st, I think, or 30th, I think. Is there a 31st in August? It's 31st. Yeah, cool. 30th.
Yeah.
Something like that.
It always August ends longer. Yeah.
So we brewed then, and then there was nothing down here, man. You know, like when we got our building, even we're in an area called the Edge District. So we're technically considered a part of downtown, but we're on the edge of downtown. And the way the city kind of is set up is it's pretty dope. It's a peninsula, but on the sort of near the south east side of town, right on the bayside of the water. So right on the water is the heart of downtown. So you have the bay, and it runs west from there. And there's one street that goes from east to west all the way to the other side of the peninsula called Central Avenue. And basically around Central Avenue out west, downtown stretches till you get to the Edge District. And then at the end of the Edge District is our big interstate, 275. Once you cross that, you're technically outside of downtown. So to paint the picture of what it looked like pre us opening, all of downtown St. Petersburg from basically like the 700 block, which meaning literally seven blocks from the bay heading west, all the way up to us, which gets all the way to 1700 block, was like boarded up. Mm-hmm. So about 10, 12 blocks of just like not much going on. There were no businesses. There was no one was down here. And we got the building because it was in a great location, we thought. But everyone thought we were crazy because there was nothing down here. All the businesses around us were boarded up. There was the lot that our beer garden is now, which is like this overgrown lot with like chain link fence around it. And so we built this out. There was a couple of restaurants around us, but like they weren't doing too great, except for one that had just opened about 4 months prior called The Bodega. And the bodega was making Cuban sandwiches like across the street, and they were killing it. So we opened, and then it became like a small destination for people where they'd come downtown, they'd grab a Cuban sandwich, they'd walk over to Green Bench, and they would just crush their Cuban and drink beer. And so we built this little hub sounds together pretty good. Because of that. The only other really sort of thriving business in the area near us was this small, or not really small, it's a sports bar called Ferg's. and it's directly across the street from Tropicana Field where the Rays play. And it was kind of like the official bar for the Rays. So, and we're like a block and a half from the stadium. Like you walk out of our door, you could see the stadium. You sort of fast forward, a few years go by, and next thing you know, within a year, there are probably 6 breweries that are now open in St. Petersburg, or 5 or so, that opened right after us, and it just kind of snowballed. In that time as well, about a year and a half in, the University of South Florida was kind of interested in starting a brewing arts program, so me and a few other brewers kind of hopped on and helped them found that. So I'm like a founding faculty member of that. So I teach at USF St. Pete Brewing Arts. We've been doing that for about That's awesome. 5 years. And then as more education was created through sort of programs like that, more and more breweries started opening and businesses started popping up around us. And now we have this very thriving downtown district all the way from the Bay, not even just to the edge, but now down past through the edge, down into the next, you know, sort of neighborhood over called Grand Central. And then there's even a neighborhood beyond that that's kind of thriving, just continuing to head west. So now there's just a pocket of just tons of stuff that even I haven't been to all of them. There's so many. So it's just,
that's incredible.
And then, and it also coincided with a lot of condos and apartments being built downtown. So there's a lot of people sort of moving into the downtown sector that weren't here before. Like I went to high school here and there was nothing downtown when I was growing up. Like you came down here if you wanted to like you were going to either buy some drugs or skate on some shit. Like that was like the only reason you came to downtown. Like nobody came down here. Yeah. Like I never came down here because it was just devoid of anyone. So now it's completely different, man. It's a really busy, fun town.
That's incredible.
It's so cool because I did like all growing up did the very like typical Maine go to Florida for a week in April thing. And then my parents kept doing that after I was in college and stuff and went down my senior year of college. So that was 2012. And we would always go to a Rays game. So quite familiar with at least the lack of stuff that was happening in St. Pete for a long time. So then it was 2012 and 2015. I also had 2015, I remember obviously Cycle was open. We really didn't do much, but I still remember like, okay, a little more is happening.
Yeah.
But clearly the humongous leapfrog since then. And I realized as you were talking, I was going to be there in March. And then that I was literally heading to the airport and my wife who does like HR and stuff for us basically called and was like, yep, trip ain't happening. So, okay. But, I did want to talk a little bit about just sort of hearing you. And it always sounds so stupid to be like, you know, I've heard things you said and you and me, we were like, but there's certain things to your arc that I was reminded of myself in just mostly like, all right, super young kind of approaching beer of like, there's a lot here, sensing that very early. And then, I mean, the breweries opened the same year, and you were talking about 21 being like the year that you could kind of, and I wasn't doing like specific style six packs or anything like that, but there was a beer store, very lucky in the place I went to college that just maybe not freshness was the biggest thing there, but just a humongous amount of beer. So that really was formative. So that part reminded me a lot. And then also when you were talking about like, continuing to keep the engine running today is just always about like the constant proximity to new challenges and just almost perpetual pursuit of them. Obviously those change a lot from those early homebrewing days to now. So I from my end, I wanted to start with just kind of asking what is keeping your engine running today in that way in terms of what, you know, what are you doing most days, I guess, in short?
That's a good question. I mean, I think, to start, there's definitely a lot of similarities there then between, you know, how we started, you know, when I was 21, I was kind of bored. And so I was in college. I was actually working two jobs. I was working at the hospital and that I'd been at for several years. And I was working at a radio station on campus at USF, and I've still found like, and I was going to school full time, but I found all this time on my hands. So I started homebrewing. My father was a homebrewer in the early, in the mid 90s. So I think that's really the first spark for me when it came to, at the very least, what it was I was bored. I wanted a hobby. And I was like, what should I do? First thought was like, what did my dad do when he was bored? And then I was like, oh, he used to make beer. Well, I don't know if I liked that at all, but I don't fucking know anything about beer. So let me start there. And I would go to like our Total Wine, massive chain of, liquor and wine. And they had this big wall of beer. And just like you, yeah, I mean, I think looking back, it probably wasn't the freshest beers in the world by any means. but it was a substantial amount of them. So I would just go get like a mixed six pack of, like, I'd pick one style and I downloaded like the BJCP app, and which is just free. And I would just pick a style and say like, okay, that weekend I'm just going to drink this six pack of whatever the fuck the thing was, right? Like the example I always give, like an obscure one, is like Northern English Brown Ale. All right, here we go. And I would just like drink, just drink those. And so then after a year of doing that, I had built up like this really solid base of understanding of not just how many styles there are, but what makes them what they are, what is the difference between styles of beers? So I was really prepared, I think, for the next step, which was, well, how do you actually make it? Which was the next thing that I jumped into, like right before I turned 21, or the year I turned 20, or 22 rather, the year I turned 22 is when I first brewed, and just kind of fell in love with it. Right. And luckily, because I had spent a lot of time researching prior to starting, that sort of base of knowledge. And typically that's how I go about stuff. I don't really jump into something without feeling like I can really bite into it. And, and the first beer that I actually, same, the first all grain batch that I ever brewed, like I was my first statewide medal in a homebrew comp. And I was like, cool, they give you medals for this. This is rad. And so then I just decided to keep going. So I think to jump forward from that sort of curiosity that I had, when I was 21 years old, now what, 14 years ago or something like that. I'm still just as curious, I know that there's a ton of beers and styles out there, and I know a lot about it now, right? Over the course of those years of learning, what I've also discovered, the more that I learn, the more I find that like, I don't know that much, it's like one of those, like the more you know, the more you've realized like you don't know a lot. And, absolutely. And I think that's ultimately why, what's kept me interested. In addition to that, it's like, beer is the heart of it, right? And fermentation is the heart of it. And I'm constantly learning every single day. What also helps me is throughout that journey, I think about, the 13, 14 years of being a part of this, the amount of people and influence that have been around me just continues to blossom, And I think that really helps me stay motivated as well. There are people in my life now that are extremely, extremely important to me that weren't in my life because I wasn't, before I was in beer. And that keeps me really motivated. Frankly, at this point, our staff keeps me really motivated. My partners keep me really motivated. My family keeps me really motivated. I'm just in a position now to help so many more people around me that I just wasn't in. And I think that just keeps me very, very excited. Also on top of that, there is just this really other small thing, which is like, I'm typically just like never satisfied. So, I don't sleep as much as I should. And I constantly, I'm just like, I was literally thinking about this morning. I was thinking to myself, like, this term, right? Like, you're your own like worst critic or your biggest critic, whatever, however you want to say it. Yeah. And I think that for the most part, that's true. But I think that I also have a pretty, pretty like educated self-awareness as well when it comes to like where we or I stand in the scheme of what I'm doing. Like having had the fortune of being able to travel and being able to learn as much as I have and experience as much as I have in our sort of bubble, I know where we are compared to, you know, the best in the world typically when it comes to that thing. Now, you know, a lot of that is sometimes, you know, kind of subjective, but I do think that there is a standard that experience has allowed me to put on myself and ourselves. And I think that number one has allowed me to feel confident in what we do, but also understand just how much better everything could possibly be, every experience could possibly be. I think that's always really helped my motivation, and it just keeps me sort of driving forward on a day-to-day basis to answer that part of it. You know, I typically try to be in the brewery Monday through Friday. You know, I get here in the morning and I'm here until the afternoon. Try to get home to see my kid and family. And you know, day to day, I don't really make beer anymore unless I really, really need to. So I kind of run everything that has to do with our beer. Like if it has to do with our product, that's kind of my responsibility. When it comes to recipe development, scheduling in the production schedule, ordering all the raw materials, sourcing everything, to the process in production, how we're brewing in each individual beer, what we're adding, what we're not adding, timing on, you know, yeast and fermentation. And I check all of our lab results every day, and I make decisions on and answer questions all day long on everything we're going to do on every single tank. And through the transfer process, through the packaging, carbonation and packaging, like I test every tank every day. I taste every day, all the way up to the formats, the brand, the name, the label, the, you know, when it gets packaged, where it gets sold, pricing on it. I set all those, and then basically all the way through when it hits the tap, what glassware it goes in, how we talk about it, what, you know, what the experience should be around it, and try to facilitate that conversation kind of, because it started with me as an dude that was just sitting maybe in an office or driving somewhere. And I thought I wanted to do, or drinking at someone else's establishment and being inspired.
Then
from that moment, I have to facilitate that experience kind of from the very beginning all the way to the end. So that's typically what I do. And then after that, it's, you know, a lot of managerial stuff. It's tons of meetings with, you know, the heads of our business and the leaders that we have internally, interviews, meetings with my partners, and, just planning, you know, big picture stuff. So that's kind of my day to day, I guess.
Hell yeah. On paper, very similar to what my day to day is. The thing is, since we both kind of got in it from a physical place, like you do this physical thing where you are inextricably linked to the thing you're making.
Yeah.
Over the years, motivation was never, ever hard for me early on. Cause like you said, you're confronted with this just abyss of knowledge you don't have every time you do something. But I've felt kind of we've talked a lot about it on here, but the last couple of years, like being my own worst critic has basically evolved to being my own worst troll. As time has gone and like the things that I'm supposed to be doing have become less obvious because they're not as physical. I guess I've had a hard time with that transition a lot. Not from the will to want to kind of make it, but basically the things are harder to find. I know damn well that there's just as many things that I should be, the percentage of knowledge I have versus what's out there probably has not changed, because technically like more knowledge is being created all the time. So I'm probably in the same tiny sliver I've always been. So I know that it's still there. It's not that I feel like, well, I guess I've learned it. but it's just the routes to learn more, the routes to like, they change and they become almost harder to find. Have you experienced any of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the routes to sort of learning have definitely changed, namely because like there's more access first. I mean, like I have I have an unbelievable amount of access to things now than what I had, you know, 13, 14, 15 years ago. And even not even in my necessarily like position, but like there just is a lot more information out there than there was back then. And, you know, and I think now granted, I still feel like very fortunate to have gotten into it when I did, because there's considerably more information when I got into it than say when my father was homebrewing, you know, nearly 30 years ago.
Or yeah, you might as well have been in a castle.
Yeah, it was absurd. Like he couldn't. My dad learned how to homebrew off of what was the book? It was Homebrewing for Dummies. Remember the Dummies books?
the black and yellow
branded Dummies.
Yeah,
books.
That was the one. So
that's incredible.
That's how my dad learned. So I had a lot more information than he did, because there were message boards and forums. You know, Homebrew Talk was a huge one. I would be on there all the time, kind of just reading what people were doing. We had the internet, so that helped. And now it's just like, I mean, you could learn anything you wanted to about beer. Now, I do think on top of that, my access to sort of probably more technical things is also pretty vast. You know, like I'm very fortunate to be in a position to almost be able to pick the phone up or email kind of anyone and sort of get an answer, which is just awesome. But yeah, I mean, I think the access to that has continued to help me stay motivated too, because it's just more shit to learn, you know, it's just more shit to get better at. And what excites me more than almost anything is not only like trying to capture that thing and learn, but it's also sharing that experience with as many people as possible. Like what jazzes me is when I get, you know, as a small example, right? Like when I learn about something that I'm excited about, like in the last several years, right? It's been, you know, I've been doing a lot of lager production and trying to fine tune it in a way and understand it as deeply and intimately as I can. And as I learn and as I experience and as we get better at that production, it just excites me that I get to share that experience with the people here in St. Petersburg or anybody that comes to visit us, or friends in the industry that either visit us or I send beer to. You know, it's just like that part gets me really, really, really excited.
Bringing that back to the people that shared it with you and to initially get you into beer and get you into a professional capacity. I'm certainly one of the heavy hitters of Florida, Cigar City, where you started. In listening to your stuff, I really just want to ask frankly, because I heard it sounded like obviously a very formative experience for you. And you talk very openly about being fired from it. And I've never heard any details about why, but when you to bring it forward, it seems like you guys have a very good relationship now. I think if I understood correctly, you've hosted celebratory events for them.
I don't hear about that much.
that's got to be on good terms. I was so curious about, A, just that experience and how it formed some of your brewing philosophy. But then how does that go south and then end with such a happy ending? If you wanted to talk about that experience a bit.
Yeah, of course. So I got fired from Cigar City. I worked there for about a year, maybe just like a little bit less than a year. And, it was very formative. It was a very important time in my life. And I learned a lot from that experience in a lot of different ways. So first and foremost, back then there really weren't too many other places you could go to like learn what I wanted to learn. And Cigar City was kind of the only game in town, of that scale of that style of beers. Like no one was making IPA like that, like High Lie, and no one was making anything like Cigar City was making. And it was so, so exciting. It was thrilling. I was very fortunate enough to get a job there and become friends with the people that work there who are still my friends today. There's no hard feelings that I specifically have or harbor for anyone that was a part of that experience really with me. Honestly, it would be silly, especially now in the position that I'm in and where I've gotten to feel any sort of ill will for anybody. And
absolutely.
And I think it was it was a very difficult time for a small business like that to grow with no blueprint in front of it. Cigar City went through some amazing growing pains that, you know, we all are, you know, we still learn from. We still get to observe and sort of see how maybe they did something or dealt with something. And then we can use that as like an opportunity to either do what they did or do something different than what they did based on your analysis of that. And totally. And I think they were, you know, they were caught with just being the first group ever experiencing those things. So they didn't always make the right decisions. They didn't always do the right thing. And they didn't always treat everyone the right way. And I openly think that they would be the first people to admit that. And, you know, it's like when I started working there, it was a bunch of really young dudes. And even, you know, Joey was young. And the sort of management structure, I think, was a little unorganized. And it was just, they were infants, man. You know, like I think back to that time and it's just crazy to think that that business like operated kind of the way it did. Not to say it was a bad experience to work there daily, but it was just, you know, it was, they were trying to figure out how to run a brewery. And totally. A business at the same time. And it's not to say Joey didn't have some at least leadership skills by any means, but especially a mentor in his father who was an entrepreneur. But, you know, basically when I started working there, I worked packaging. I was taught how to clean a bright tank and I was bottling Hi-Li every day. And yeah. I really got hired by Wayne, the head brewer at the time, now the brewmaster. And he I started bringing in home brews and he and I started having like some deep conversations kind of about beer philosophy and some, you know, stuff. And we kind of gravitated towards each other and really understood each other well. And so I started bringing in home brews and management loved him. He loved him. And he was like, you need to have Joey try this. And Doug was on my board too, on my side. Doug was like, dude, you like, yeah. We love your beers. Like this is, you need to be on the brew house, which I guess is, looking back, not even necessarily, I think how maybe would be even the right choice if, you know, in that situation, but like that was
how old were you at that time?
Like 22, 23, maybe.
Gee, that's yeah. incredible.
And it was interesting too. Like there was this hierarchy, right? That was there, right? Where like, if you were a volunteer, you like bottled beer, right? That's what you did. And if you got hired, the first thing you did was still bottled beer and kegged beer and you would, you know, clean a bright tank. And then if you got promoted, mm-hmm. you'd become, you washed kegs. And then if you got promoted, you would be on the cellar and you would work in the cellar. You get paid a little bit more money. And then there was like a head cellarman who got a little bit more. And then if you really were good at any of that, I guess, or you spent enough time there, the next step was you became a wort producer. So you became a brewer. And that was like, and you got paid the most in the brewery. And you, you know, that was the goal for everybody. So there legit was like there was competition for that hierarchy. Like no one, who wants to package if, you know, your ceiling is, you know, is this, and a brewer's, you know, starting is what your ceiling is, or, you know, more maybe. So totally. It created this like competitive hierarchy and nature within the business that, you know, honestly, I didn't think was super healthy. And I felt, you know, and I tried my best to not really even be a part of it because I kept thinking to myself, like, look, I'm not here for like, necessarily a career. You know, I didn't think about it that way. I was here to learn and I was here to just like learn as much as I could and just contribute anyway. And if that meant I had to work to become a brewer so I learned more, you know, then so be it. But I will say at the very least, it didn't feel to me like they were withholding information from anybody as far as growth. You know, like I could find out what the brewers are doing, but I can't physically do it, but I can learn that thing. So they weren't like keeping that knowledge from me, but there is a capacity of knowledge that is different amongst the group. And I do think that I walked in package or, you know, bottling beer with a capacity for knowledge of what's going on greater than maybe some of the people that were cellarmen and even some of the people that had already been hired to the brew staff. And I think that that was apparent in the beers that I was making, even at home, and the conversations that I was having with management and staff. And so I got, basically I was promised that I was going to be on the brew house within like, this is like a month or maybe two of me working there, which is just crazy.
That's the fast track.
And there were a lot of people that had been there a lot longer than I had. You know, I'd been there a year maybe, or even more, that were, you know, putting their time in to kind of get there. But because I was, had this capacity for like more, then that was why they wanted it. And so very quickly that got shot down. You know, Joey's like, I don't know this kid. Like, no, I have other people in line, and I understand his decision making completely. So then they promoted me to this role called the treatment specialist, which back then Cigar City would make like, you know, a handful of beers base, and they would fill them up into corny kegs and do like treatments on each one of them. And this is how like if you want rape beer, everyone, like one of the things that Cigar City was known for is having more styles and types of beer on tap at all times than fucking anybody ever. And so like, so they would release more beers in a year than ever, but really it was like High Lie, and it was, you know, 40-50 different versions of High Lie, because I was filling these corny
every
kegs.
Type of cedar ever.
Yeah, right. And it was like, you know, peach High Lie and fucking passion fruit High Lie, and it was just like treatments. So Joey was doing the treatments, and Joey saw an opportunity to say like, well, I'm not going to promote this dude to brewer. I don't know who he is, and you know, whatever, people are going to fucking be really mad. So I'm going to give him my job, and I'm going to teach him how to be the treatment specialist. So I ended up doing that, and I did that for a while, and I was basically flipping kegs of treatments, and and
treatment love.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it was, and I learned a lot from it. Learned how badly I would never do, how much I would never do it, and it just was. But there was also like, maybe that was my ceiling now, which was fine with me. Again, I wasn't really here as a career in my head. I was here just to learn as much as I could. But because my schedule was different and because my job was now different, there became some like tensions between some of the people that were there earlier than me and had been there and maybe, maybe hadn't gotten the attention that I had gotten. And eventually there was an issue where I came in one day, on my day off actually, because of another reason, but I came in and did something. And then I was leaving later that day or the next day to Atlanta, and I had to prep some stuff, and I was like, I had to get an oil change. So I came in on my day off, did some shit. I was like, I'll be right back, guys, get an oil change. I left, got an oil change, came back, finished what I was doing. And then I was told, and then fast forward later, a few weeks later, I'm working and I get called into the office, and the woman that was running HR at the time, she's like, hey, there's a time card issue. Apparently you were in and then you left for like, you know, 40 minutes and then you came back, but you didn't clock out. I was like, you're right. It was this time and this time. I went down the street to get an oil change. I forgot to clock in and out. So if you want to remove that time, like, perfectly fine. Sorry, I did that. And she's like, well, yeah, so we're getting more corporate. We're going to have to let you go for this. And I was like, okay, that's interesting. Like, are you serious? Yeah. And she's like, yeah, we just have to, you know. And I was like, okay. And so I kind of objected, and I was like, this is kind of crazy. This is seriously, like, over this? Like, and
yeah,
her response to me was, you should talk to Joey. And I was like, okay. So I spoke. So she's like, just talk to Joey. Just talk to Joey about it. So like, you know, it's kind of on the record that it was a time card discrepancy is why I was let go. I was distraught and I was upset about it. And I went home and, you know, I was very upset. Called Joey. And we talk on the phone. He talked to me for like an hour, hour and a half. And we had a great conversation. And basically he kind of just laid out what the kind of, you know, ultimately like real reason was, which was like, look, man, like it's a tough position right now. He's like, it's no hard feelings. We like you. Everybody likes you. It's all good. It's not to say you can't ever work here again. Like, that's not how I feel. I just feel that for now, it's best if you leave, because I have a lot of people complaining about you and your role and like your track and all that's like, and I guess like there was a rumor that like people were calling me the poster child of Cigar City or something. And like, because of how quickly that track was going. And there was some jealousy, and there was like some, and he's like, I just don't need that. Like, you know, so, and from his perspective, I get it. He probably was like, I either have to fire like five people or you.
Right.
And, you know, and like, and it's just, it's too much. And like, I just don't have time for this shit, and it's more work, and it's just, it doesn't make sense. And so like, for now, you just gotta go. Cause this is just not working. And I completely understand his decision, you know, while, you know, I still think a lot of the ways in which all that went down were probably not handled correctly in the way that I would handle them. And maybe not even the way they would now. But I think that this is all like learning experiences, not just for me, but for them on how to handle these, you know, in the future. And again, we were still friends. Like we would still talk, you know, I would still go to the brewery and drink. And, you know, if I saw him walking down the street, we'd stop and shake hands and talk and catch up. And then, you know, I left there, ended up working at a homebrew shop that was here locally that wanted to open a small brewery. So they wanted my assistance in that and just moving the shop because we moved locations. And we opened that brewery, ran that. And after going through the process of like filing with TTB and like the local government, you know, things that I didn't know, after going through that process, I kind of had built up enough confidence to say like, you know, I could open a brewery. Like, I think I can do it now that I know how to do this. And so that was then my first decision and pursuit to say, okay, I want to open a brewery. And then I had a couple failed attempts, you know, like I had a couple business partners that seemed like it was going to work. And then last minute it all fell apart. And I was pretty discouraged for a little bit and kind of felt like, you know, fuck it, I'm going to do this by myself. And then I was really fortunate enough to meet my current business partners, Nathan and Steven, kind of right around that time when I was like, I'm never doing this with anyone else. And then the three of us opened Green Bench in 2013. And then you fast forward a year into that, and Joey calls me and says like, hey man, it's our 5th year anniversary. Everybody loves your space. And he was here like when we were under construction, the guys at Cigar City would just come hang out. Like there was a day where like, like Joey, Justin Clark and Wayne Wombles just hung out. We're in the middle of a construction site, just sitting there drinking beers. They brought over some High Li and some beers. And so we just like, they were just always there for us. And they always helped us with any question we ever had. And our relationship honestly got stronger, I think, throughout all that process. And so,
yeah, can I stop you there for a minute and dig into a part about that? And then do kind of Green Bench opening. There's a bunch of stuff I want to ask you about there, but this almost feels so stupid for me to bring up and say, and I'm going to have to dance around this a little bit. Because generally as a person, I'm not a person of huge confidence and I'm not a person of huge like self-worth and belief in self. It's gotten better over time. But at the same time, what you just said and everything you said about the Cigar City story to me is very interesting because you have an output that is like super, like rock star shit. You're doing great shit. You're doing really, really well. But your feedback loop from sometimes, if your light shines too bright, can almost be negative feedback for the good output. And I think a lot of people deal with this sometimes. And for someone like me, just to be honest, I'm big, I'm boisterous, I'm loud, and I constantly have to remind myself anyways, just in my general flow, like, dude, tone it down 10%, listen to this person more than you talk at them. And these are kind of the constant battles going on in my head. Success, and that isn't the word, but it's like, I need to almost, the feeling like dim your light a little bit sometimes. Yeah. It's such a stupid metaphor, but I think you would very much understand what I'm saying. So coming out of that experience where you do great things, have bad feedback for it, how did you internalize that and carry that forward? Because you classified it yourself as a big learning lesson. How has that shaped things from then on to where you still continue to see success?
Great question.
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. You know, I think that it's a combination of probably a few things. The first one is I'm a very confident person. I think that there's an interesting sort of play there. Like I'm a very confident person, but I'm also a fairly insecure person at the same time. You know, like there's And I think it comes from like what I sort of try and do. I don't say I pride myself on it necessarily, but what I attempt to do is try to be as self-aware as possible. Understanding like being able to look myself in the mirror, being able to sort of try and analyze my behavior and how I internalize things and then how I project them, not just on others, yep. but also on myself. And I think that that's a struggle I've always kind of had. And I think it's a thing that I've always tried to learn from and try to figure out ways of even communicating, even like with myself. I think that one of the ways in which I've been able to take, frankly, failures, is I try to always keep a context of, you know, there's a failure. I have two options. I either can fail at something and sort of let it, I guess just be what it is and just, you know, give up. Or I can take that failure and try to use it as either motivation or try to analyze that failure in a way that'll just prepare me and make me, frankly, more confident going forward. So I think I do my best to try and build up my confidence. And I found that one of the most because I am an insecure person.
To have like a reservoir, you mean?
Yeah, I try to maintain a level of confidence in myself at all times. And I think that what I've learned is failures are the perfect opportunity for me to sort of refill a lot of that charge, right? Because I do my best to try and analyze a failure and I try to come out of a failure after analyzing it more confident than before I failed, if that makes sense. So I think that like,
it must be nice.
So I think that like when that happened, I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, it crushed me, you know, like I went home and I felt like this is it. It's over. I'm never going to be in this industry again. I'm never going to learn what I want to. It's back to the drawing board. You know, and I had a support system around me that kind of told me that wasn't the case. Even people at Cigar City. That were there for me in that process, including Joey. You know, I mean, he literally was on the phone with me for like an hour and a half, almost 2 hours, like telling me, you know, what it actually was. And I think understanding that he didn't have to do that, you know, like, I felt like when I walked away from that conversation and I slept on it, you know, although I had my emotions and I was in them.
Totally.
I was able to understand that like I could just wallow as much as I want, or I can listen to what this man said and I can analyze that situation and I can use it to be even more confident in my next endeavor. And I feel like that's kind of what I did. One of the vital things that I felt like I learned from that experience was that if and when I open a brewery, I'm going to work as like what's as important to me as anything in this business is to make it, I'm trying to eliminate that hierarchy. I don't want to hire someone in my production facility who is coveting someone else's job in, you know, around them. Yeah. Like, so, and that was a very important aspect to, you know, that I felt like not only did I not want to put anyone else in that position, but I didn't think that it was honestly the best way of getting as much out of the people around you as you could. And I contemplated that structure a lot after when I was wallowing in that failure. And I analyzed how I wanted to treat the people that decided to work with me, you know, in my dream, you know, like this is my dream. And they made a decision to trust me enough to work with me on accomplishing that. Like that is, and I try my best to just never take that for granted. And I think it took me going through things like that experience at Cigar City to feel as appreciative as I am of the people around me that just are helping me do this cool shit. And yeah, so I think I'm trying to get back on track to exactly what maybe you were asking, but and maybe I even lost it. I don't really know exactly.
Well, let me help you. There, because what you're describing is like an extremely difficult thing for most people. Like, if I put myself in your shoes, at being like fragilest ego as possible, because I'm trying to form my ego, getting in within the context of an industry.
Exactly.
Like, yeah.
Am I worth working in beer? If that had happened to me, if I had been fired as my first, I think I would have switched careers straight up. Like, I don't think I would have been able to reverse engineer a way that I got a lot of at least healthy motivation that wasn't just like completely resentment driven. Like,
hell of a motivator, not very sustainable.
I definitely lean on the resentment motivation more than I should. So I guess though, like to be specific, like how do you think you were? I know this is broad, but it also must be kind of simple. How do you think you were able in kind of your most vulnerable time in a lot of ways to spin that for
flip
yourself.
That switch that you talk about.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, I'd be lying if I didn't also say that there was in a lot of those failures, not like what allows me to analyze it the way I do, and I think it crossed my mind to quit for sure. I mean, it was on the table, and it was something I almost did. There is a level of like, you know, pride in me too, though, that makes me be like, fuck that. I'm going to do some shit that no one's ever fucking done because you fucking told me I can't. Mm-hmm. Right. And I don't even necessarily feel like that's what Cigar City was saying to me. But I can use that energy to motivate myself into doing something, you know, maybe not necessarily greater, but doing something more, you know, like, And I think that there's a way to take that energy and just use it as a challenge yourself, you know, use that energy to continue to challenge yourself into like, not just being better, you know, at handling those failures, cause they're going to keep fucking happening. But also to stay like proud, you know, like that's a, you know, staying proud of who you are and how you handle things and learning from your mistakes, like doesn't necessarily like there are mistakes I've made in my life that I'm not proud of and things that I've done that I'm not proud of. But I'm proud of who I am because I went through them and because I did some fucked up things or learned something from, you know what I mean? Like, so I think that by not being proud of something that you do, sometimes gives you more pride in yourself in the long run. If you choose, and ultimately this is, I think I do consider this a strength of mine, being able to choose how something affects me. I've been able definitely to do that throughout my life, I think, better than most. And honestly, I think if I really were to try to analyze that, it would go down to my childhood. I was a very angry child growing up, and there were a lot of options for me to go down completely different paths that would have, you know, been very, very terrifying, frankly. And I think that because I had a great support system, my family and my parents, and they did everything they could to kind of instill confidence and pride in me. And they did, I think it really starts with them, that when I think about some of the therapy that I had to go through as a 9-10 year old, because of how angry I was. There were techniques and process that I had to go through to learn how to control my temper, which was a very volatile one. What I learned from those experiences is that when things go any direction, you have a choice on how you behave and how you feel. Like feelings happen, but I try my best to not place my feelings responsibility on anyone else or anything else. You know, if someone pisses me off, I don't say like, it's their fucking fault I'm pissed off. Now, what they did led to me being pissed off, but I chose to be pissed off. You know what I mean? Like that was that I'm responsible for my own feelings and no one else is responsible for them. And so I try to always, if I'm hurt or if I'm depressed, because I have been depressed, you know, and I've been for years in my life have been wallowing in anger and all these things, all of those, you can choose to feel those. And sometimes I do, because I'm a human and sometimes I want to be in my feelings. And sometimes that, and what I've discovered though, is the longer that I'm in them, the more decisions I make that I'm not proud of.
Hell yeah.
And so I think that like, if I want to have confidence in myself and I want to build my pride in who I am and how I treat people and how I treat myself, it, all of my forks in the road typically are when I have a choice on how I want to behave and how I want to feel when things are maybe not going the way I want them to, or even when they are going well. You know, like it's, and I don't always make the right choice. And it's moments that I don't make the right choice that I hopefully can learn from and then, you know, become even better to people around me and to myself afterwards. It's tough, man. It's a lifelong thing that I'm, you know, I'm never probably going to get right. And I'm just going to keep working at it. And it's just, you know, that's it.
I got to tell you, man, the empowerment of that realization that not, this is my choice. This is also, everything is my fault. Everything is in my control in terms of how I react to it.
Yeah.
That realization saved my life at my lowest moments, for real. But to pivot it back to beer, coming out of those moments, you work at Southern. So now you've had the brew side of the equation experience. Then you get the business side, or the opening side of the equation experience. The
permitting side.
Yeah. The permitting side.
A very important side.
The town hall side. Yeah. But you put those together and embark on Green Bench. And to me, I think there's a pretty normal trajectory of breweries. A lot of ones we've talked to, a lot that we've seen in that 2013-14 era that – frankly, they make hoppy beer and they do really well off that. And they build up this base that then allows them to scratch their artistic itches and go to other places. See a lot of breweries that have opened mixed firm facilities in the last three or four and really get focused on lagers and a trajectory that's different for everybody, but follows a similar path. But it seems like you really came out of the gate with this kind of broader approach. I think if I read correctly, one of the first fooders in the South and maybe like the seventh one in the United States at that time. What was kind of where you were at as you did rise like a phoenix from those situations? I wanted to say it. I'm sorry. Like you really came at this with a ton of, frankly, ambitious energy about how you're going to go about your own dream.
Sure.
Well, where were you at in that space?
Yeah, I think when we were first opening, you know, we talked about a lot of stuff, and one of the key ones was community. Was you know, I was born in Memphis, Tennessee, but I grew up here in St. Pete. You know, I was there till I was about 10 years old, and then I moved down to Florida, and I've been here since. And I grew up here in St. Pete. My two business partners are born and raised St. Pete. One of them is like third generation in the neighborhood, and we cared a lot about this city. So we talked a lot about community and we talked a lot about, you know, a grander vision for what we wanted this place to look like for our children and their children. And, you know, for kids like us growing up here, you know, what it was like, how we described it, and then what it could be in the future. And so I think we wanted to be a safe space for everybody. I think that was number one for us. And then on top of that, we wanted to set ourselves apart from the crowd. And luckily, it wasn't too hard for us because they were actually the things that we were interested in. You know, like the market was very saturated, not saturated, because it really wasn't saturated at the time. It was just of the options that you had, everyone had, you know, an IPA, which, you know, I'm not sitting here saying we don't make a lot of IPA. We make more IPA than anything else. You know, our number one seller is a West Coast IPA called Sunshine City, and it's 40% of my production. So we make a lot of IPA, and actually I would say that of core brand beers, 55% of our production is core brand IPA total between other two IPAs. And that's just overall production. So we make a lot of it. So we definitely wanted to do that. We wanted hop forward ales because I love making IPAs. I love IPAs. I love hoppy beers. And but another style that I was really, really, really fascinated with were Saison and farmhouse ale, very specifically early on. Those are the ones. And I was also very interested in nuanced sort of, you know, acidic beers, you know, maybe not necessarily, you know, and back then too, it was, you know, even kettle souring was a fairly new endeavor for a lot of breweries totally. At the time. And so we kettle soured a lot, and we were one of the first brewery probably in the state that had a sour IPA. And, you know, we were 2014 making sour IPA, or actually 2012 is when I first made one. And we brought it to a festival in 2013. Like we were in planning. And so we had the first sour IPA in town. And I was a creature of like, of exploration. And what I wanted to do was open a brewery that set itself apart, that, cared very much about quality, over quantity, and that also cared about, continued growth. And when I say that, what I mean is I didn't want to open a brewery and then sort of learn what I learned and sort of move, you know, just keep doing that. I wanted to open a brewery with a big fucking challenge in front of me, which was crazy because opening a brewery is already a challenge. But on the beer side, what I mean by that is like I started to research, you know, oak, and I was researching. There was no one in town doing, you know, there was obviously some barrel aged stouts and stuff like that. And frankly, I'm not a huge fan of Imperial Stout. I mean, they're okay, but. And I like trying them, but I really don't like drinking them.
Quite the contrarian in Florida.
Very drinkable.
And honestly, and I really hate making them. So, you know, I just was like not, it was just not really for me. And there was a lot around me, so I didn't feel like I was, you know, like, you know, a bit leaving a hole in the market. But
right.
Totally.
But the gaping hole was sort of, you know, farmhouse saison and sort of nuanced acidic beers. Now there were kettle sours, like I said, Berliners and Gozas, and to say there weren't breweries making saison would be false. I mean, a lot of breweries were making a saison, and then you could think about Bob Sylvester and Saint Somewhere. So he was here in town, and he's a massive inspiration of mine and a friend. And so then I started researching ways in which people produce these, and ultimately the fooder came down to there aren't a lot of them. Which means there's not a lot of information out there, which means I'm going to have to.
There's a challenge.
Yeah.
There's a challenge.
Exactly. Which means I'm going to have to learn a lot, and I'm going to have to develop process or help develop process for this thing, which I did by getting one. So we were the first brewery in the southeast of the country to have a fooder. We had it the day we opened. It was a custom built fooder, and everyone thought I was fucking crazy. Like every brewer was like, what are you doing? Like I had a brewer friend of mine pull me aside. It's like, dude, you were going to ruin your brewery. Like, what are you doing? I'm like, I promise you, I'm not saying that won't happen, but I am saying that like I know more about this than anyone else around here, and it's because I spent a lot of time researching it, and I think I can do it, and I'm confident that I can do it. And you know, so we open our doors being like, yeah, we make 100% oak fermented farmhouse ales and a custom built fooder, hop forward ales, and you know, sours. You know, and that was kind of our tagline of like what we made, and it did not work very well. So. Nobody gave a shit. So
then your friend comes back and he's like, hey, what I tell
yeah,
you?
Right? No, it worked in the sense that our beers were fucking awesome. But what sucked was, you know, I mean, we just talked about this. We're the first brewery in St. Pete, Florida. People are walking in like, what is this brewery thing? And you tell them like, oh, this is a, like I said, a dry farmhouse ale, you know, fermented in a fooder of 75% French oak and 25% American oak, you know, has notes of orange peel and white peppercorn and is effervescent and a little cloudy. And they're like, what the fuck are you talking about? And so they would just leave. and also back then we weren't making lager either, because like lager was not something I knew anything about, frankly. Like back then you got to think, like I said, I was trained at Cigar City and then Southern. And while I made lagers sometime at home, it even really wasn't a thing that homebrewers did much in Florida. There were some that did them, but it just wasn't really a focus. Like there were two trains of thought there. One was, why the fuck would I make a lager when, you know, you go to the grocery store and it's all lager, you know, like let's make IPA. Let's make this thing that is the market doesn't already have. And I can't make it for that cheap. And then number two, it's just fucking harder to make. Like it just takes longer. It takes double the amount of tank time when I can flip High Life three times in the amount of time it takes me to do one of these lagers. And it just doesn't make sense. And then on the homebrew level, you have to buy a shitload of equipment for it because we're in Florida. It's hot all the time. So it's not like you have a basement. You can just throw something in the cellar and be like, we're good. Got to have a backup
compressor on that cooler.
So it's just like, so you just needed, it was energy and it didn't make sense. And there's, the market already has a bunch. Why are you doing that? Like, doesn't make sense. So none of us were trained on lager. None of us knew what the fuck we were doing. And so I just never made lager because I didn't know enough about it. And then I spent the next 3 years really diving into lager and as far as learning before I tried my first one here. And then, you know, as I've just learned more and more, we started making more and more. And, you know, now Postcard Pils, as I did, ran the numbers just for this year so far, year to date, Postcard is like 21-22% of our overall production.
Damn.
Hoorah.
Wow.
Yeah. Hoorah. Wow.
Pretty fun. So yeah, we it just kind of snowballed into it, and I think it worked out well for us because by the time that happened, the market was definitely ready for it, and it's a great thing to drink here. What I had to shift at doing, and this is actually what kind of made our mixed culture sort of wild sour farmhouse side work, was shift the conversation to say, like, these beers fit what you like, you just don't fucking know it, right? Like, you come like you drink, like, we're a massive import state. Now, when I say import state, we're not like pulling in Belgian beers or beers from like Europe. It's mostly like Latin lager. Like there's a ton of Corona and Modelo and, you know, Pacifico and like that. Those are the big drink or most drank beers really like on the coastlines of Florida. Now, granted, there's a lot of just domestic beer too, but the elements that you like about them, their drinkability, their softer palate, all those things, Saison is perfect for that. You know, like, and so it was a matter of, and even higher carbonation, like light lager, a lot of people don't realize, like light lager, a massive important part of light lager's profile is really high carbonation.
Yeah.
And so when you have the ability to have that conversation with a St. Petersburg market that has no idea what the hell they're getting into, you find that a beautiful 4.5% effervescent, dry, clean saison fermented, you know, co-fermented with sac and Brettanomyces, you know, on a really nice tropical soft character played really well with the palate experience that they were used to. And so we just kind of shifted our conversation to kind of talk about not what the beer is necessarily and like hitting them over the head with process, but more what the drinking experience of this thing is and how it aligns with what your expectations likely are if you're that, you know, demographic. And that really helped us, I think. And then obviously, like, just being the only brewery doing it, eventually what happened was is the consumer – what we strived at doing in the very beginning, what we ended up accomplishing was we built a level of trust between ourselves and the consumer here locally where they just, they just trust what we make. They may not know what the fuck we make. And frankly, they might not even like necessarily the thing, but every consumer that walks in here knows that if we made it, it went through a massive amount of care and research and development. And it's not just made because it's made. And I do think that there's a lot of, I go to a lot of breweries myself and I'll drink the beers and I kind of just am like, yeah, sure, you have all these styles, but there's no integrity behind what it tastes like, you know, like what it, there's no, like you just did it to put something on there and there's no follow through. And to me, that's a disservice to like who you're selling it to. And so I think we've built that sort of trust level. So now we can kind of make oddball off the wall shit and people buy it, which is kind of cool, you know, like
hell yeah,
like I can't believe we're selling so much smoked beer, it's crazy.
Neither can I
don't think anyone can.
It's insane. I was like,
if you're over 0.5% smoked beer, then not it's frankly a miracle. It's
unreal. So yeah, and like to bring that sort of full circle, like one of those moments that was like really big for us, there's a few moments in our career, in my career and in our life here, but like, yeah, you just to like Joey reached out to us at their 5-year anniversary and said, hey, we want to host it at Greenbench. you know, and this was like after we opened. So we hosted their 5-year anniversary. And my answer was like, dude, you can have all the taps you want. Like, you know, Mikasa, bro, like come through. It's all yours. And they had a band and they had like games and stuff. And they hosted their 5-year anniversary here at Green Bench, which was cool.
Hell yeah, man.
It's amazing. But yeah, before we close out, obviously with the state of things, and it's been a big year in beer from the progress standpoint. I think we're coming off a Brian Allen interview a few weeks ago that was incredible. What I would view as kind of just movement in the right direction things. That's easy for me to sit here and say, but I wanted to have you check the temperature on some of the things that you would think, and primarily talk about beer culture, because things that would not have been on my radar earlier are very much on them now. And I think that's a good thing. I'm not as much as I'm in tune, I'm also ignorant, right? I think that's the biggest thing that's come out of this last year and a half for me, is I can feel good about my beliefs and the way that I behave, but that doesn't mean that I'm not ignorant because of the color of my skin, my sex, and then I'm just not exposed to things that other people are. And seeing more of these things being more accessible to everybody makes me feel like we're moving in the right direction. So I know that you guys have done Culture Tings, Culture Chronicles, have been very involved with that, and kind of talk about what beer culture is and where it stands and the mission behind that.
Absolutely, yeah. So Beer Culture is a nonprofit based here in St. Petersburg that was founded by Leticia and Dominic Cook, husband and wife, and dear friends of ours. And so I was fortunate enough to kind of meet the Cooks years ago when they moved to town. They're from the Bronx originally, but they've been here for several years. And Dom was trying to get in the industry. You know, he was driving the brew bus, and he was, you know, worked at a couple of local breweries. And he and I kind of gravitated towards each other because there just aren't many people of color in the industry, as you guys are aware. And
totally.
So we would talk on the phone sometimes, like about, you know, and we would postulate questions. Like he would ask me, like, is the beer industry racist? Like they would ask me that. And I was like, damn, like, fuck, I don't know, man. Like I don't think beer isn't, but like, you know, there is a system in place that it lives in that is. So, cause the world is very racist. So like, yeah, I guess so, you know? But so we had these really long conversations about that. And, you know, Dom's like him and Leticia are really beautiful people, man. They spend their lives, they have spent their lives helping people around them. You know, he's been involved with charity work since he was, you know, a youth, and has always had that as an important part of his ethos and who he is as a person. So
that's awesome.
He, you know, when they kind of turned their culture into like this lifestyle brand, and it started to catch some steam like online and got a little mm-hmm. popular, you know, relatively speaking in the industry, and it was turning some heads. And I got it when I opened Webs finally, which was like 2.5 years ago. It's our second tasting room, kind of mixed culture focused, facility and barrel house. And then actually he and I were sitting right here, like literally in the stool right next to me. And, cause I called him, I was like, yo, let's have a beer. I want to talk to you about something. And I kind of was like, yo, I want to create a charity tap, is what I said to him. Like, I want to have a tap online at all times, 100% of the time, where if you buy a beer from that faucet, we're going to donate money to a charity from it.
That's awesome.
And I just want to pick your brain because I've had my head down, man. I've just been trying to run this business, and I've kind of been in these four walls, and I haven't, you know, especially having opened this second facility, I'm not as in the community as I used to be and I wanted to be, and I am now for sure. But back then, I was like, I'm looking for a nonprofit, but I want something local, like hyper local, like not Florida, not Tampa Bay, like St. Pete, like something in our town. Cause I want our neighbors to walk in, give us money, and then we give that money back to the neighbors, right? Like that's totally what I wanted. And so we started talking, and he was like, you serious? I'm like, yeah. And he's like, well, you want to do a collab? And I was like, sure. So he helped me find this nonprofit locally called Building Beds, and we started the Culture Chronicles series. So the idea was that we would make a new style of beer, you know, once a year or so, and then we can rebrew it, but kind of once a year, kind of have a new beer in the series. And we donated all the profits and proceeds to Building Beds. What they do is they build beds for kids that don't have them to sleep on. And there's like an estimated 7,000 kids in Pinellas County that don't have beds to sleep on every night. So we've been donating money to them, and we even like volunteered our time to kind of join them and like build beds and homes for kids, which we've done. And it was dope. It was cool. Like, I wanted to be hyper local, and it kind of struck me because the last house that me and my girlfriend went and built beds in was like 5 blocks from my house. And I was like, damn, like they're in my neighborhood. Yeah, like this is like,
yeah,
like this is as hyper local as I can get. I'm building beds for kids in my neighborhood, you know, like literally where I live. Yeah. And so it just kind of snowballed. And then like we made, you know, volume 2, which is the Keller Pills. And then the next year, and it was all kind of weighing on Dom. Dom was kind of getting he was getting real frustrated with the role and the response and the lack of commitment that he was feeling the industry was not giving him. And he was putting more into it for less. And it was kind of killing him. Honestly, he was feeling terrible. And I kind of saw the writing on the wall and it was coming, but then in 2019, that summer, they called me and it was on like a FaceTime call with Tisha and Dom. And they were like, hey, we just want to tell you before we tell everyone else and announce it, but Dom's stepping down but Tisha wants to take over. And I was like, well, that's cool. And then Tisha starts telling me all her plans of what she wants to do with it. And she just like black woman the shit out of it. Like overnight, the shit was organized. There was a website. There was like, fuck, it was insane. And then like, and I messaged her and I was like, hey, let me know if you need any help. I went to the website. Love it. If you need help finding some, you know, board members, like I'm here for you. If you're looking for a craft expert, I can fill in that role now to kind of get it off the ground until you find somebody for that role. And then she replied with, actually, I was hoping you'd be the vice president. And so I was like, well, all right, let me think about it. And then like a couple days later, I messaged her and it's like, I'm in, let's do it. And then we kind of talked about the scope. And then her and I finished writing what the board member roles were. And then her and I took in applications for them and did all the interviews and filled out the rest of the board together. And then we started planning initiatives. And so Beer Culture now is a nonprofit that whose goal is to, as we say, change beer one beer at a time. It's long work. It's not overnight work. It's stuff that we're committed to long term, are slowly but surely going to provide pathways of entry, try and raise the ceiling that a lot of people feel that they have, and really kind of open the eyes to people that the industry of beer is a lot more broad than you realize, and that the skill set required for the many different roles that beer provides are vast, and that there are people in, you know, our community and specifically in our African American communities that are perfect for these roles, and maybe they don't realize it or know it or even feel like it's it's even for them. And so, yeah, we just been tackling that for the last year or so as a nonprofit, and it has been amazing. It's been great. So yeah, that's what we do, man. We have scholarship programs through Cicerone. We have Sparks Foundation, which awards $5,000 grants to 5 black men, 4 black men, 4 times a year. And that are looking to, entrepreneurs looking to open any business, not even necessarily have to be in the beverage space. And we're just trying to empower people to let them know that this is a space for them and try to set it up so, you know, there's more people that look like them that have accomplished things that, you know, they can. And yeah.
Awesome, dude. I think we'll probably, I'll have to get at you after this, for some more specific details, but, we actually are brewing today down in Portland. The first beer kind of in a relatively similar program, I guess, that we're implementing was kind of a brainchild of a woman who started working with us at the beginning of the summer. But basically not as a specific minority focus, but just really anyone that isn't a white male, pretty much. We'll brew a beer, sell that to basically fund a multi, like 3 or 4 week paid internship for some sort of minority, whatever that may be, to basically the whole idea is to show kind of what you're talking about being like, this is what beer is, and to equip someone with some skills. We're not necessary if they obviously if they're amazing, like, yeah, maybe we can keep you around.
Keep on. But,
basically equip them with the skills to get a job elsewhere. So there's a lot of the biggest kind of lack of clarity so far has been just a lot of the nuanced stuff, and certainly the scholarship element of it, and funding for that kind of thing. Like, funding's not a huge issue, but just how we could be doing more with it. But
of course,
as good of a conversation that is, I think it will have to be largely email based. But awesome fucking stuff. And I know we could be here for another hour easily, but I know both of you guys have to get working, and I probably should get heading home. But Chris, this was awesome.
What a conversation.
Yeah, I know, man. Honestly, we barely even, I had so much geek questions to ask you about beer. We didn't even have time to get there.
All the technical stuff is.
Yeah, all the reason for another one.
Absolutely. Anytime you guys want, we'll talk technical. I know you mentioned Fooder for Thought. Whenever you got to talk about that. So there's plenty.
Yeah, I know. There's plenty. There's a lot.
There will be
man.
A part two. Hopefully in person in Florida when
there we go.
I like
beer
that
travel
idea.
Picks back up again.
But we always wrap up kind of a little silly. Matt can walk you through that, and I'll set you up.
After we grain in, we got to hit the three-bay sink, clean it all up, shut it all down. So we do what's called the three-bay. We're going to give you three things in one bucket, and we're going to give you three in another. You're going to put those three things together like a free association, and you're going to tell us why. Okay. Noah's going to give you your categories right here, and it's going to get a little looser and a little more creative here to round it out.
Based on Instagram, is it fair to intuit that you are a car guy?
Yeah, I am.
At least from the year 1968.
I am into cars. But that is kind of a newer fascination. That is not something that I've been in my whole life. That's kind of a new thing that it's a hobby that I picked up because I fucking turned my last hobby into this. So,
I need a new challenge.
Communication about like upgrade. I'm not like, I use one, you know, I use a car. I think it's really cool, but it's very much not my world at all. But from the comments I saw on Instagram of like lots of numbers, lots of letters of upgrade stuff. So it made me feel like you're at least deep enough into it where you'll be able to answer what I'm about to say. So
all right, we'll see.
I'm going to just give you three kind of classic 1968 classics. So I'm going to have you pair up three Green Bench beers with each of these cars. I think they're all be cars you know. We got the Mustang GT, Steve McQueen and Bullitt.
Yeah, baby.
Very famous. We got the Charger RT. That was like the stripes, kind of the introduction of racing stripes on a muscle car. And then the Pontiac GTO, one of the most famous cars of that era in general. Are you deep enough in cars where that's cool for you?
Yeah. I think I can handle that. Cool. I think I can handle that. All right.
With three Green Bench beers.
Three Green Bench beers. All right. So the first one, you said it was the Mustang GT, right?
Yep, yes. The Bullitt car.
Okay. So for the Bullitt car, I'm actually going to pick, I'm going to pick Bench Life, which is our premium lager. I think it's like one of the more unassuming beers that we produce, and it's like nuanced and elegant, and it has like unbelievable character, especially when you like continue to dig down on the outside. Ooh. On the outside, it just looks fucking beautiful, right? It's just like, it's just classic, unbelievably pretty. And then as you start to dig in, you're just like, you just kind of get more and more impressed with like the little nuances of it. Next one was the Charger, right?
Yeah.
All right. For the Charger, I'm going to say that's a tough one. Charger.
It was the first year of the Stripes.
Yeah.
That's mostly what I know.
I'm gonna say for that one, I'm gonna go a little bit different. I'm gonna say Feel the Love, which is a mixed culture saison that we produce, and it's basically oak fermented and then blended on the back end, and we use a bunch of aged hops on there. Where it just has like, to me, it's like that car is extremely it's like a noteworthy car. Like you look at it, you kind of know exactly where it came from. Mm-hmm. And I think that it has like roots is kind of what it feels like to me. And so I think that like Feel the Love reminds me of that, because Feel the Love has roots in like a lot of inspiration. We use those aged hops that we age in our attic over here to create almost like this very like old age lambic kind of aroma and character. And so
bro,
I think
how
about
hot is that attic real quick.
So it's basically like 16 feet in the air, like in our rafters. It starts 16 feet and it's like up like literally in the humid air. And so we take aged hops and we throw them in burlap sacks and just sit there and throw them up there, and they just sit for a year, 2 years or something. And we dry hop the beer with that to give like this really like rooted character. Like it's
totally.
Like,
yeah.
And so that's kind of like how I would think of that. And last, the GTO.
That's a great answer.
GTO is so good. I'm going to say like, I'm going to pick a beer that we recently brewed again. And it's back now. Actually, today we're releasing it again. And we hadn't made it in a while because honestly, I had a hard time just sourcing the hops, and now I have access to them a lot more regularly. But it's this beer called Happy Hermit. And it's an international pale ale. It's 4.9%. Kind of has an amazing, it's Galaxy hop focus. I just have a larger contract on Galaxy now than I used to, and I kind of ran out of Galaxy, so I hadn't made it in a while. But to us, it's like one of the, before I started making Postcard Pills, which is the beer I drink every single day, Hermit was my daily drinker. So 4.9%, solid bitterness, dry, clear, sort of, pale ale, whose focus is like Columbus and Galaxy and the dry hop. I'm going to pick that one because it's one that I haven't had in a while, because again, we haven't made it in like over a year, and now it's coming back into production. And it's one of those beers that, because it's not necessarily around all the time, it's like out of sight, out of mind. I kind of forget about it. And then the moment it comes up and you sort of see it, you get so fucking excited. And to me, that's what Pontiac GTOs are. Like they are one of the most iconic cars that you'll ever see, especially in person. But to me at least, of Dodge Chargers and Mustang Bullets, like I feel like those come up in my feed or in my sort of
totally.
Like I see them more often. But the GTO is the one where like, oh yeah, no, I don't remember seeing you that much, but every time I see it, you're my favorite. Like that's kind of like it's kind of like how I feel about the GTO. So yeah, that would be probably my choice for that one.
Well done, dude.
Is the Impala that you have, that's not really technically a muscle car, right?
No, or so that year, really when you get to like 67, really 67 to 68, they really leaned into kind of muscle car quite a bit. It had a original Power Glide transmission, which a lot of like drag racers and people in muscle cars love those transmissions, even ahead of maybe some of the newer transmission builds. So it was considered kind of muscle car. Yeah. The nice thing about the Impala, especially the 68, is it kind of lives in a few different worlds here, right? Like it is muscle car to a lot of people that are into muscle cars, and I like muscle cars, but I'm more into like, 60s, 70s kind of, almost like exploitation, that kind of vibe, low rider,
excess
slow riding,
era.
Like that kind of like, that kind of vibe is more mine.
Yeah.
And it lives in both those spaces. Like the 68 Impala can look clean, rolling slow, or flying down the path. So it kind of depends on what you want. And it was 67 where they really leaned into those, like they call 67 and 68 the Coke bottle. builds, because the hips on the back end get like real big, like this Coke bottle effect. Uh-huh. Whereas like, so you got 64s, which are like really straight lines, 62 to 64, pretty straight lines in the back. And then you get to 65 and they added like a little hip behind the back window.
Starts to get curvy.
And then 66 kind of is about the same as 65. And then 67, they went real curvy. And then 68, they just leaned into it. So the 68, they threw out a ton of different models. This was like the more models they had than any other Impala previously. And mine is a fastback. So it just is one big swoop all the way down to the tail. And it's got these hips that sort of follow that line. And yeah, she's just like, you know, she just cruises, man. Like that's the game.
Hips don't lie, baby.
I would really like to see it in person someday. But again, Chris, thank you so much for doing this, man. This was an absolute blast. Would love to do it again. And yeah, hopefully within the year, I'll get down to your place, man. Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Thank you, guys.
I'll hit you up with an email after. Thank you so much for taking the time. What a way to start a day.
Indeed.
Let's go serve some people some beer.
Yeah.
Appreciate it, brother.
Cool. Thank you, guys.
Cool. I'm in the mood.